prejudices of Detroit polyglot population awaited the new army of war workers. Subversive organizers and native Nazi orators took to soapboxes outside a dozen war plants.
I'd rather see Hitler and Hirohito win than work beside a Negro on the assembly line.
Detroit was dynamite. The fist fight on the Belle Isle Bridge set off the fuse. By the dawn of Monday, June 21st, Detroit blew up.
An open letter on race hatred, 1943 Peabody Award winner on this Saturday's Golden Age of Radio, 7 to 9 o'clock. World War II radio drama, until it's over, over here.
And in the great factories of Detroit, which proudly claims the title of Arsenal of Democracy, few men worked that day. From bloody dawn to bloody dawn.
And it's 9 o'clock in the evening on a Wednesday night, time for Off the Hook on WBAI, New York. This is Off the Hook, the program that deals with technology, computer hackers, and other assorted mischief in the high-tech world. This is Emmanuel Goldstein. We're together until 10 o'clock, and tonight we might have a special guest. We're not going to say for sure if we are, because we're not 100% certain ourselves, and we just don't want everybody to go crazy and panic and that kind of thing. Speaking of going crazy and panicking, I'd like to step outside the normal boundaries of the program for just a couple of minutes to relate what went on at the 2600 meeting last Friday. A week ago, things seemed calm, you know, throughout the country. Things seemed rather normal. But within the course of a few hours, and certainly over the course of the last week, we see just how easy it is for all of that to suddenly go away. And, of course, I'm referring to the events of Los Angeles, the Rodney King verdict, which was announced about 1 week ago, and all hell broke loose in Los Angeles that night. Now, at the 2600 meeting on Friday night, we were in a city filled with rumors, and consequently the attendance of hackers and other curious onlookers was down quite a bit. Citicorp Center was closing up all of its shops. People were running home, literally, and all kinds of reports of horror stories, ANS in flames, Penn Station being stormed by thousands of people, and Port Authority shut down. All kinds of rumors were being spread around, and of course, we tried to find out from the payphones what exactly was going on, and really weren't able to get through to anything. It's very interesting when you take a group of people such as ourselves and pit them against something like this, an uncertain situation. We had scanners. We were listening to the police radios, which technically, you know, is illegal. If you're driving in a car, you're not supposed to be able to listen to police scanners. I don't quite know the reasoning behind that, but suffice to say that we bent the law a little bit that night because we wanted to find out just what in the world was going on. And we heard of reports of quote-unquote trouble in Tompkins Square Park and 14th Street, Union Square, places like that. And the voices on the radio were becoming increasingly, less radio-ish and more human. They were losing what they call protocol and speaking English. And, you know, when they start speaking English, that something is up. And certainly things were happening. Downtown in the Village, as anybody that was down there on Friday night knows, everything closed down. 24-hour shops shut down at the latest at 11 o'clock. At around 7:30 or so, there was a march down 8th Street heading westbound from Tompkins Square through Astor Place and over towards Broadway and 6th Avenue. And that's when probably things were at their peak. Now, I happen to be online at that famous automatic teller machine on Broadway, the one where everybody lines up into the street. I don't know if it's because it's such a popular machine and everybody loves it so much, or because maybe it's the only machine around for a mile. One of those reasons, everybody is always crowded into that little vestibule there and lined up out into the street sometimes, as was the case in this particular instance, where things seemed rather calm and everybody was going about their business, although there was this specter of something bad on the horizon. We didn't know. And, you know, riots aren't really something that you plan out. It's supposed to be spontaneous. That's if you want to have a decent riot, you got to be spontaneous about it. No good sending out invitations and things like that. So online at the ATM, waiting, everybody patient, everybody knowing something's going on outside, but not quite sure what. And then we were gestured at by people in the street, kind of a warning gesture, as in, get your asses out of here as quickly as you possibly can. And so I went outside to see just what that was all about, and saw this mob of people heading westbound on 8th Street. And I said, oh, boy, this sure looks interesting, because you could see that they were a shouting mob of people, you know, group of people throwing things. We didn't know what they were throwing. It could have been paper bags rolled up into balls. Could have been balls. Could have been rocks. Who knows? We didn't know. They were far away, and they were approaching. And there were people running towards us. And all of a sudden, you realize how quickly something can get out of control. We warned the people in the bank machine, said, you know, maybe this isn't the best time to get money. And the machine cleared out like you just wouldn't believe. The line just went away, and people evaporated into the street. At that time, the crowd started passing us. This was right on Broadway. And panic ensued. Not a tremendous amount of panic, but enough panic so that you could sense that control was about to be lost. About that time, police cars started coming down the street at full force. Some were driving down the sidewalk at 40 miles an hour at least. And it was a sight I'd never quite seen before, where police cars were doing that. And I realized that the sidewalks were designed so that cars can drive down them in times of emergency, because they didn't hit anything, no people, I don't think. And they were making pretty good speed, and that was their way of getting around all the cars. One of the most unusual things, though, that I saw downtown that night was a yellow cab pulling up, and pouring out of the cab were policemen in full riot gear. Apparently they had hailed a cab someplace with their helmets and everything and gone and taken it downtown. It was the weirdest sight I'd ever seen, and it didn't look like they tipped the guy very well either. But the important thing is, things kind of calmed down after a while on their own accord. There didn't seem to be a massive show of force to the degree that that, you know, there was brutality or anything like that. Not that I had heard of, anyway. And people were able to vent their anger, as well they should, and New York was calm. Quiet, abandoned, but calm. It also goes to show you that the things that we take for granted, whether it be our communication systems, our computer systems, or society in general, they are very fragile. And it doesn't take much to get a crisis started. And just like other countries where we turn on the news and we see rioting in the streets, we see army troops stationed on every corner guarding against uprisings, you see the same thing here. All it takes is a little bit of pushing, and we reach the exact same stage. It happened in Los Angeles. I saw a picture in the paper the other day. A truck filled with troops watching as school kids pass by on their way to school. And it's something that you say to yourself, hey, this is America. We're supposed to be so far above that kind of thing. But we're never far away from the breakdown of society and from hearing what people have to say and what angers people. And, you know, if there's reason for the incredible force of these demonstrations and the violence and the anger, it's because people haven't been speaking for all this time. Think of it, 12 years since Reagan was elected. And a lot of you know what's happened in those 12 years. To have all that bottled up inside of you and have it come out now, that's a dangerous thing. It's a real dangerous thing. And it will be interesting to see what the future holds, because things certainly aren't going to get better in the present state. You hear the blame for all this has been put on the Democrats back in the 1960s. They created the welfare state, and they're responsible for all of this. And that sounds to me like a dying argument. The argument of somebody who's cornered and has no place else to lash out at. Will be very interesting to see what happens in the future. Now, as you know, all kinds of things were cut off, limited, including telephone calls to Los Angeles during the riots. It wasn't really difficult to get through, but at one point, about 50% of all calls were being blocked at the request of the local phone companies there, both GTE and the local Bell operating companies. And AT&T was preventing at least half of the calls. I believe at one point it was up to three-quarters of the calls from getting through. And that might have added to some of the concern and might have prevented some clogged lines from occurring as well. But for the most part, technology held up okay unless it was completely destroyed, as did happen in some cases. Future weeks will be bringing you the aftermath of all that kind of thing, plus anything else that might happen between now and then, because this is a story that is by no means over. Now then, to get on to other items that have been happening, we've talked about the FBI proposal to monitor all digital phone communications of the future, something that concerns quite a bit of people, something that we've spent a good amount of time on here. This is a letter from Don Parker of SRI International in support of the FBI proposal. He says the intercept law proposed by the FBI is in need of the full support of the cyberspace community, but requires some additions that are disturbingly absent. The proposed amendment to the Communications Act of 1934 is necessary to perpetuate an essential capability of law enforcement to protect the public from crime, and particularly to protect the privacy of individuals whose personal information is communicated. Now, I'm going to step in here for a second. It's interesting how something that basically is concerned with eavesdropping, listening in, is being done for the protection of privacy. You know, it's that doublespeak argument again. This is war is peace, freedom is slavery, and monitoring is for privacy. Anyway, he says that he hopes organizations such as EFF and CPSR, Computer Professionals with Social Responsibility, can address these particular shortcomings that are needed to protect all the stakeholders from unauthorized use and misuse of the interception capability. In other words, people that can access whatever the FBI has installed into these phone systems. What's going to limit it to just the FBI? It's just legal interceptions as well. Clearly, access and usage security controls are needed. In addition, recording of all intercept activity is needed for audit and evidential purposes. Finally, only the FCC rulemaking proceedings should be kept secret that would aid and abet unauthorized persons to abuse the capability to use the intercept capability for bad purposes. Some detailed information about the auditing and safeguarding must not be revealed. So, in order to protect the secrecy of this particular system, the hearings should be closed to the public, in Don Parker's view. It's a very dangerous idea to introduce something so sweeping, so totally complete, and then not to tell people what's going on. I think we have the right to know how the system works, and hopefully people will try and find out exactly what it is they're proposing. Technically, we already know what it is on the moral grounds, and it doesn't pass muster so far, at least not in my opinion. Here's a reply from Joel Upchurch. What I disagree with is that it's a bad thing for police authorities to be curtailed by advances in technology when it comes to tapping into phone conversations. It seems to me that if tapping a phone conversation is difficult and expensive, and the funding for such efforts comes out of the budget of the police agency involved, then it is far more likely that such tapping will be used with restraint than if using it is cheap and easy. If anything, I'm worried that technology is going too far in the other direction. I suspect that the major cost of any phone tap isn't the cost of placing the tap and recording the conversations, but in paying people to listen to them. It reminds me of Bucharest in Romania, when they uncovered the Securitat offices and saw all the cassettes that had been recorded over the years of Romanian citizens. And they'd never been listened to because there was just so much. Oh, there was a lot of monitoring going on, but where were the monitors? They couldn't find enough of them. Anyway, to continue, it isn't collecting data that is expensive, but analyzing it. With the advent of computer voice recognition in the next few years, it is quite possible that this cost will decrease drastically, maybe by an order of magnitude or more as the technology improves. I keep asking myself, how is the FBI proposal different from one that would require audio and video surveillance equipment be placed in every home at the expense of the homeowner? Even if there were strict controls to make sure the equipment was never used without a court order, I doubt that most people would approve of it. What if the FBI required me not to seal my envelopes, since it would inhibit their ability to surreptitiously read my mail? It's not so much the idea that they want me to pay for it, it's the idea that they want me to pay to give them capabilities that I'd be willing to pay for them not to have. That letter from Joel Upchurch. A lot of reaction against this proposal is coming in, but people need to be educated. People need to write letters to the New York Times, to the various weekly magazines that the vast majority of the American public reads. Because this is something that, once installed, will never be taken away. Now, let's talk about some foul-ups and blunders and things like that. A software bug in a crucial FAA computer, one that programmers had identified and had planned to fix, acted up recently before they could get to it, shutting down the computer and disrupting Northern California air traffic for about 2.5 hours. A spokesman for the Federal Aviation Administration said a backup computer system immediately kicked in, and that while departing flights were held back at many airports, no planes in the air during the shutdown were ever endangered. At least, not as long as they stayed in the air. And then the Oakland Air Routing Traffic Control Center in Fremont, California, had receivers for 12 of its 50 radio frequencies go dead on April 17th. The partial outage lasted for about 1.5 hours and delayed 36 outgoing flights from San Francisco, 7 from Oakland and 1 from San Jose. The reason was undetermined. And something I don't have in front of me but I heard about was some sort of a foul-up in a weather computer in Oklahoma. A blizzard warning was issued earlier this week. Temperatures were in the 50s, I believe. Not exactly conducive for a blizzard, but the warning was issued anyway, and nobody knows why or how. But it had something to do with the computer. That's all they're saying at the moment. All right, here's something out of Hawaii. 3 weeks ago, most of the mainland switched to daylight savings time in Hawaii, and unbeknownst to city transportation officials, a microchip controlling traffic signals on the, Kalaunalio Highway, or something like that, contained the program written on the mainland that contained an automatic conversion to daylight savings time. So, on Monday, April 6th, the timing for peak traffic hours kicked in an hour earlier, throwing signals off. Signals that were changing in 200-second cycles began to change in 185-second cycles. Now, that's only a 15-second difference, and it only lasted an hour, but that was enough to mess up morning rush hour traffic, which is pretty bad on that highway. So if you ever want to completely foul up something in a city, go for the traffic lights. It's a guaranteed way of doing it, except in New York where it happens anyway. And you know, it reminds me of something about a year and a half ago when a major cable was cut accidentally by a workman who went down a manhole cover. He cut this cable, and all of a sudden, just about all of AT&T's northeastern traffic was out. That's right, completely out, completely wiped away. And I ventured over there, it was in New Jersey, and took a look at this manhole, and it was so nondescript, so average-looking. This poor guy went down there, and he was hiding, too. He didn't want to talk to anybody. He was in a trailer. Accidentally cuts this little tiny fiber optic cable, and it says no redundancy or no backup system, everything gets wiped out just like that. It's simply amazing how they design these things sometimes, and how more of these incidents aren't occurring virtually every day. All right, advancements in technology. Foodmaster Supermarkets is pleased to announce a new electronic payment system to be used for making purchases at three of their Foodmaster stores. That's throughout Massachusetts. Foodmaster is excited to be the first in the area to offer this new service to its customers. This, by the way, is an advertisement. So in case it sounds kind of propagandized, that's the reason. Any customer who has a Yankee 24, Baybank, or Express 24 ATM card can utilize this system. The customer at the point of checkout simply passes their card through the magnetic reader located at the checkout and punches in their secret ID number, and the transaction is automatically processed. Foodmaster is pleased to be working in conjunction with Yankee 24, Baybank, and Manta Systems, a division of Bypass, B-U-I-Pass. And this new system will be available through the month of April. It'll be starting to be available then. Now, here's a comment from Ruth Bork off the Risks Computer Digest. Although the language carefully and slightly hints otherwise, I assume the service is optional. The usual obvious risks apply here, such as PIN protection, both external and internal, sale to others of both the customer's names and or their buying habits and multi-bank information. And there's also a new twist here. Banks never tiring of riding herd on their yet-to-succeed debit card pursuits are now putting this pressure on with attractions via one of the consumer's most vulnerable points, the basic staple of food. I wonder if supermarket check cashing will shortly become more complicated. And continuing along, some of the other great advances of technology. This one is rather frightening, folks. Rather frightening here. Those of you with cellular phone calls, or cellular telephones, rather, who receive cellular phone calls occasionally, hopefully. Listen to this particular incident by Brian Cush. He said, while traveling through Georgia recently, my cellular phone rang. Since I was roaming, I was not expecting a call. When I answered it, it was a recording welcoming me to Bell South Mobility and offering instructions on using their service. I've had this happen before and didn't think anything about it, but today I started to think. If the cellular phone company could sense that I had come into their area, that means they could track my movements all over the country on a carrier-by-carrier basis. They might even be able to track me within a city area by which antenna was picking up my signal. It's a scary premonition there of a future of services. It gets even scarier when you listen to what Phil Brown, who's a project engineer with GTE Mobile Communications, has to say about this. Not only could the cellular phone company track one's movement all over the country, although with great difficulty and expense using today's switches, it is an active industry goal for the next generation of technology. Call delivery, making your phone ring when someone dials your number regardless of your geographic location and serving carrier of the moment, is an integral part of the standard being developed for inter-switch communication. It's also seen as a key to making personal communications networks work. What happened to you in Georgia is the result of a feature known as autonomous registration, by which the serving switch instructs a mobile unit to register and is transmitted its identity information, including mobile phone number and serial number, as soon as radio contact is established, as indicated on the mobile's handset display by the service light or service bars. When the system detected that you were a roamer, it placed a call to your phone and played the recorded greeting for your edification. Although, I don't know, Bell South's policy, it's quite unlikely you were charged for this call. Furthermore, automatic vehicle location services, known as AVL, are also seen as highly desirable by a significant subgroup of wireless communication users. Truckers and victims of car thieves come immediately to mind. There are companies that claim to be able to determine the position of a mobile unit in a cell site to within 100 feet using only the received 800 megahertz radio signal. That is a frightening claim there. The technology, though, at this point, is unreliable and expensive. The most popular solution is to marry a global positioning system known as GPS, one of those receivers to a cellular phone or other wireless terminal, but this is both proprietary and also expensive. As long as the user retains the ability to disappear by turning the phone off, I see the benefit is outweighing the risk in this form of network tracking. I squirm a lot when I read about beacons placed in every car for automatic toll collection and vehicle monitoring because these specialized systems exist solely for the purpose of tracking and accounting. And does anyone really expect there to be an off switch on such a device that's there for tracking and accounting? I don't think so. It's one thing to choose to be tracked, quite another to have an eye in the sky checking up on you. But maybe it's something we ought to start getting used to. All right, and to wrap that up, another story about this very same thing from Kevin Paul Herbert. He says, I was talking to my mother yesterday about a new device that she had installed in her car, required now by the insurance company, in order to insure the car at full value. The device tracks the location of the car with sufficient resolution to even give the driving speed. We're not kidding here. It's getting that advanced that they can give you a driving speed. That is most frightening as far as I can see. In any event, the device tracks the location of the car with sufficient resolution to give driving speed. He says, my father called up the service to test it out, and they said where my mother was driving, as well as indicating that she was driving 30 in a 35. If she did not get this locating device, her insurer would have only insured the car at up to 50% of the car's value. She didn't know anything about how this data could be disclosed. She hadn't really thought about it. Okay, that's the advancements of technology for this week here on Off the Hook. We do have a special guest, and he's going to be arriving momentarily, so stay tuned. Meanwhile, we'll be taking phone calls as well, 212-279-3400. Welcome back. It's Off the Hook until...
...1969 when I had a random call from somebody who had called me. Either I was experimenting around with a new transmitter and asking people to call me if they received it, at which time I got a call from this guy, Denny, who identified himself as Denny, who then gave me some accurate information on my signal report, gave me a phone number to call him back at. When I found out it was later on, it turned out to be a telephone company test number, a loop around, and I kind of shrugged it off. 2 weeks later, he calls me back again. I asked him about that number he gave me. He said that was a special test number, a loop, and that's when I started getting interested in all that.
Uh-huh. And what year is this?
69.
That late? I always thought it was earlier in the 60s.
No, 69.
Really? And now what has changed with the technology since then? Obviously, that 2600 hertz tone, which is what the Captain Crunch whistle was. That,
about 1979 uh-huh. until about 1984, the phone company switched over from in-band signaling to out-of-band signaling.
Okay, now for the listeners, could you explain out-of-band signaling?
Out-of-band signaling is where the call setup is done not over the same wire pair that you use with your voice, but over over a special data channel, which is inaccessible for phone hackers. Back in the earlier days, one would send 2600 hertz down the phone line, which would then be detected by the toll switching equipment, would disconnect you from the number you had been connected to, at which time you would then be on an open trunk line, and then you would use the blue box or 2600 whistle to dial a call that way. Back before 1970, it was possible to call an 800 number that terminated in Little Rock, Arkansas, and use the Captain Crunch whistle to make a call. And then Little Rock, Arkansas got cut over to the multi-frequency tones, at which time that was then the norm.
Uh-huh. And that's true blue boxing, though, using the multi-frequency tones, correct?
Right.
Now, this doesn't work at all anymore?
I think in 1984, the last American exchange cut over to CCIS or CC or whatever it is for out-of-band signaling. I believe at that point there might have been a few end offices or some small offices up in northern Canada that might have been boxable, but I don't really know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm told it's still possible to parts of remote Canada and maybe even some parts of, in the United States, too. I've heard rumors of things like that are still possible.
Might be possible.
Uh-huh.
But it's a lot easier to call and blue box from anywhere outside the country now.
Well, it's also possible, is it not, to call one of those toll-free numbers that go to another country and then use their phone system from that, correct?
That's what people have been telling me. Recently, I've been getting a lot of calls from phone hackers or computer hackers on the Alliance conference.
Uh-huh.
Someone in the past have discouraged them from calling me, but because of my presence on the IRC internet chat and other conferences,
mm-hmm.
I've been a little bit more open about it, and I always try to tell people and discourage them from doing it as much as I can. The biggest problem I see, and this is from hackers that have called me, is that a lot of hackers now have been telling me that if they ever get busted and thrown in jail, that they're going to have hacker lessons in prison and teach all the prisoners how to do it.
Interesting concept.
Yeah, I thought so too. And I said, well, you know, you got to do what you got to do your time. And I advised them that if they ever found out that they were hackers, to do what they say. If they want information, to give it to them, because if they don't, their time in prison is going to be made extremely miserable. I am speaking from experience because that has happened to me.
Now, when did that happen, and what were the circumstances of you being in prison?
I was in one of my busts in 77 in Pennsylvania. I was going to Northampton County in eastern Pennsylvania, where I served 4 months there. And at that time, I was approached by some pretty heavy-looking dudes who had seen the TV news, me on the TV news about my arrest and incarceration, and they said, oh, you're the phone hacker type. Why don't you tell me how you do that? And I says, okay. Knowing or kind of, you know, half thinking that these guys probably wouldn't really go up and check on this, I sort of gave them information that really wasn't true, and that turned out to be my demise. Suffice to say, I'm still reeling from the shock of the physical torture I had as a result of me not giving them that information. So from that point on, I haven't been resisting anybody asking me these questions.
It's quite a story. Now, what was it that got you in prison in the first place? Just making free phone calls?
Well, yeah, that was basically what I was charged with.
And they mixed you in with these hoods?
Exactly. And it turns out that these guys in prison seem to have a lot of knowledge and they actually checked up on the information that I'd given them, and they seem to be a lot more knowledgeable than I had originally expected them to be. I believe that this person was in for heavy drug dealing and was doing 15 years and on a drug-related charge, and he wanted very much to get access to the computer systems in Washington, D.C., and I had to tell him how to do that.
That's you bring up a very interesting point, where if you mix hackers together with criminals, with real criminals,
that can
criminals,
make for some extremely dangerous situations in the future.
Certainly can.
You consider, like, this guy Morris, who unleashed the internet worm, did this with a reasonably clever Unix hack, and I'm sure that there is a possibility that there's not going to be that many people in prison that are going to know how to do that. But what if that information got out to the underground and this guy Morris did something like remove all the files from root directory to every system on the internet? What would that happen?
Mm-hmm.
That cause, rather than having a little program come up and be infiltrating through and slowing the systems down, having something come up and actually remove data files, that would have been extremely catastrophic.
Yeah, and through a network, something like that could...
They would not have existed.
That's certainly true. Do you think hackers have changed since the early
days? I think they are becoming a lot more militant in ways to say that they definitely have a lot more animosity toward the authority figures than they have in the past. The kind of hackers, for instance, that I grew up and hung out with in my time 20 years ago, these kinds of hackers were just innocent, mostly blind kids that were just looking for a place to have a social meeting together. Blind kids don't get out in the real world too much. They're pretty much at home all the time unless they have a sighted person to lead them around and take them out to places and meet people. So they look for alternative ways to socialize, and they do this over conferences or over party lines. And they just they figure out how to make party lines on the by opening up sleeves on old step offices, or doing this and that to make these conferences. And that's how they socialize. That's their medium. That's their meeting place.
Mm-hmm.
And when something gets taken away from them, they just go out and look for others. They only want to just socialize. They don't have very much destructive mindset. But now a lot of these hackers, like the people in New York, for instance, that are selling time to people and making calls to the Dominican Republic, I believe I heard something on the well about that.
Well, are those people hackers in your definition?
Well, these people are probably not hackers. These people have probably gotten their codes from hackers.
Uh-huh. So it's sort of what you were saying before about criminals getting information from hackers.
Oh, that
could be dangerous.
And it's all the bottom line of this whole thing that I'm trying to bring to light out in the open, and this is important and that is the concept of technology transfer. We all know how bad technology transfer can happen. You know, what can happen if technology gets in the wrong hands. And so incarcerating hackers and putting them in jail is just going to make things worse. Because what's happening now is that these hackers that have access to this wealth of information are getting put right in the same cell with the very people that you want to keep away from, that you want not to have access to that information. I mean, prisons are supposed to be reasonably controlled environments. Well, they are to a certain extent. But on the other side of those bars, there's nothing the authorities can do. You're in a cell with another guy, or you're in the exercise yard, or you're down in the gym, and you're sitting around talking and bullshitting to your friends and stuff like that. And so these people, okay, have got unrestricted on what they can say. The guards aren't going to be listening to what you say in the yard. They're going to be up out of the way, keeping control of the situation. So there's plenty of opportunity for that technology transfer to take place.
Now, we're talking with Cap'n Crunch, one of the original Blue Boxers. I'd like to ask what you're up to presently.
Presently, what I'm doing is I'm organizing on the Internet through the Well and the Programmers Network. And some of the things that we're doing is we're providing a forum for having discussion groups on what we've dubbed now Project Forest, which is I'm laying down the seeds to plant to plant and set up a series of working groups to enhance the computer programming languages that are currently out there into putting a lot of tools and utilities on the Internet to be accessed for free by the Internet users. And my home base is on a system called the Well, and we have a conference on there where people can log into the Well. And, for instance, we've got a lot of companies that do drug testing, and we've got a complete list of all the companies that do drug testing. And this is being published on a weekly basis from another individual, and we collaborate with these people and make it known to other programmers which companies do drug testing and other social issues related to companies and how well they pay their programmers, how soon they pay their programmers, etc.
That might be a good opportunity to give out your internet address if people are interested in getting information from you, and also the number for the Well.
Contact me. I'm on the Well, and it's crunch@well.sf.ca.us. I have an alternate internet address as well, and that's crunch@netcom.com.
Okay, and you can reach the Well data by calling area code 415-332-6106 and registering online there.
And you register online by typing new user, give them all the billing information, send your check into the Well, or give them your MasterCard or Visa, and you're on. From that point, you can take advantage of the forums that we have for computer programmers. These are mostly contractor programmers or independent software writers who are just working alone to put out products on those, either as commercial products or as freeware or shareware or other programs. And we encourage all students that are taking computer science at colleges to join on these conferences as part of their curricular activities in school. A lot of the people that are currently part of the Project Forest are CS major people that are writing or working on papers, and at the same time they're working on papers, I'm giving a lot of guidance on how to set up and design software using object-oriented techniques.
Sounds like you have Carl Wading coming in there.
I'm going to get that. Why don't you go to a break? I'll be right back.
Okay, we're going to go to a phone call, actually. And
just a second.
Just pop back in whenever you feel like it. Our number is 212-279-3400. We've got Captain Crunch on the line, speaking to us from California, one of the original Blue Boxers. And we're on for another 15 minutes. Let's see if there's any questions, comments, observations out there. Good evening. You're on the air.
One comment and one question on one on your earlier news story. There's a large number of street crime cars that are disguised as taxi cabs. That the police use, and it's always occurred to me when I was driving a cab that you could somehow figure out the pattern on their licenses. The you know, the roof lights have a code that's a number, letter, number, number.
That's a very good point. In fact, I do know that there are cars that are owned by the police department that are taxis, but they use for surveillance purposes. If I had been thinking, I was too busy thinking of protecting myself, but I should have run up to that cab and gotten its license plate or the number up on top.
It's both now. The plate number and the top number are the same, as is the medallion number.
That's true. Well, you might be the person to answer a question that I've had. I've noticed some of those license plates sometimes have a little subscript 1 on them. Do you know what those mean?
They've run out of the medallion numbers to issue, so that people who have more than one taxi cab belonging to a particular, like mini fleet or something like that, are given a subscript. So uh-huh. You can be 1H221, 1H222.
I see.
1H223, like that.
Interesting.
They used to be TA or TB license plates, and then they would be TC, would be the taxi commission license plates, which would be a lot of the unmarked cars that go around.
And it used to also be that every single taxi cab had a different company name on it, too.
Right.
And that went away a few years ago.
Right. I don't know what happened with that, because I stopped driving, but...
There were hundreds of different company names.
And each cab... In fact, each two cabs would have a different company name. Even in a large fleet of 100 cabs, there would actually be 50 different companies. I think for insurance purposes, or so that a lawsuit couldn't proceed beyond the value of the corporation that owned two taxis.
And one more thing, just to exhaust the knowledge that I have of taxis, I've heard that there are only 14 checker cabs left in the whole city.
Uh-huh. didn't know that. Yeah, that's right, though.
That's a dying breed, which hopefully will come back someday. And any other points you want to make?
Just my question. From what you said earlier about the surveillance thing, it sounds like what they're really trying to set up, if I understood you right, is a central office situation where they can actually dial into any call they feel like listening to?
Well, as far as where it is located, that's not really clear yet anyway. But you have the basics right. It's something that they can tap into from any place and retrieve information.
What's this, REMOB?
We're talking about the FBI proposal, the digital surveillance.
I remember that.
Yeah, it's very recent.
That is hogwash.
Uh-huh.
That is absolute hogwash.
The FBI proposal, you mean?
What's that?
The FBI proposal.
Yes. I read that and I almost threw up on my computer screen.
Yeah, that's something you got to watch for. Let's.
I want to go over and live in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, well, they're lagging behind us in technology, and that might be a good thing, actually. 212-279-3400. Let's take another phone call. We have Captain Crunch on the line from California. Good evening. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering, have you heard of a book called In the Absence of the Sacred by Jerry Mander?
I haven't read it. I've heard that title. I don't know in what context, though.
If you didn't mind, there's a couple paragraphs in your introduction.
Okay.
That speak to what you were saying earlier.
Are they short paragraphs?
Take a couple of minutes.
Well, we'll start now then.
Okay. As we will see, the idea that technology is neutral itself is not neutral. It directly serves the interests of the people who benefit from our inability to see where this technology is headed. I only began to glimpse the problem during the 1960s when I saw how excited our society became about the presumed potentials of television. Activists, like everyone else, saw the technology opportunistically and began to vie with other segments of society for their 20 seconds on the network news. A kind of war developed for access to this powerful new instrument that spoke pictures into the brains of whole populations, but the outcome was predetermined. We should have realized it was a foregone conclusion that TV technology would inevitably be controlled by corporations, the government, and the military. Because of the technology's geographic scale, its cost, the astounding power of its imagery, and its ability to homogenize thought, behavior, and culture, large corporations found television uniquely efficient for ingraining a way of life that served and still serves their interests. And in times of natural crisis, the government and military find TV a perfect instrument for the centralized control of information and consciousness.
Witness the Gulf War, and I think that's a very good example.
Yes. Meanwhile, all of the contenders for control of the medium have effectively fallen by the wayside. Now we have the frenzy of computers, which in theory can empower individuals and small groups and produce a new information democracy. In fact, as we shall see in Chapter 4, the issue of who benefits most from computers was already settled when they were invented. Computers like television are far more valuable and helpful to the military, to multinational corporations, to international banking, to governments, and to institutions of surveillance and control, all of whom use this technology on a scale and with a speed that are beyond our imaginings, than they will ever be to you and me. Computers have made it possible to instantaneously move staggering amounts of capital, information, and equipment throughout the world, giving unprecedented power to the largest institutions on the earth. In fact, computers make these institutions possible. Meanwhile, we use our personal computers to edit our copy and hook into our information networks and believe that this makes us more powerful. That's it.
Let me just ask you something. Now, what you're reading seems to say it's a foregone conclusion that military and government will always have control over technology. Do you think it's possible for individuals to wrest that control and control technology themselves for their purposes?
Well, I think
the thing now.
That's, yeah, I see examples of that, particularly with what Captain Crunch is doing out there. Do you think it's hopeless?
Well, the point that he's saying is that just by its very nature and why it exists, I suppose, it's the corporations that, you know, computers developed. It's sort of like a medium that when television is taken over for the mass brainwashing, if you want to call it. I mean, such a powerful instrument and the money to use it behind it. I mean, we don't own the phone line. Somebody else, a giant corporation, does. And we're sort of like beholden unto that. And, you know, we don't own our own stations. We don't own our own telephone companies. We have to go into that system and they control it.
That's a good point. In fact, it brings back something that happened to me a couple of weeks ago when I was exploring a local central office that was upgrading and had a phone line, which I pay for. You know, I pay for these phone lines. And I figure it's within our rights to look at the equipment and see how it works and see what our phone lines actually look like. But of course, they won't let you in to ever see this, to ever see if somebody has attached a little bit of equipment to your phone line and is monitoring you. They don't like people to actually see how the technology works. And I think it's not only something we should see, it's something we have the right to see. We do pay for this, and yes, it may belong to the phone company, but it really belongs to us. We are the ones that make it possible. All right, let's take another phone call. Good evening.
Hi, Emmanuel. Maybe you can solve a telephone riddle that's been plaguing my uncle. He moved to an apartment, got a phone number, and started getting crank calls. He then had his number changed to an unlisted number, and the same people are continuing to make crank calls. What possible, explanation can you have for that, even though we're having the telephone company internal security investigated? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Captain Crunch, I think you might be interested in this, too. I think one of the possibilities is that the people work for the phone company. Another possibility is that somebody knows somebody that works for the phone company. Another possibility is that somebody knows how to access the computers.
All of those are certainly possibilities. I can remember back during the times when I wanted to get a number of, let's say, somebody, and I already had a working number for this guy, and let's say the next day, and let's say if I anticipate that this person is going to change his phone number, what I would do would be social engineer by contacting the switchman and talk switchman talk and getting him to believe that I was working for the phone company and having him give me the line location for that number. Once I got the line location for that number, then I could just get the number from a line location really easily.
And with that technique, you can also change somebody's number.
And if
for
the number's changed to an unlisted number, the line location number is not going to indicate that that's an unlisted number. It'll still give me the number.
That's correct. But there's a couple other things, too. And first of all, you can use that technique to change somebody's number for them without them even knowing what it is.
Yeah, and that's been done in the past. But not too many people get out of line and do that, although it's been known.
And there's other techniques, too, hooking into junction boxes. This person lives in an apartment. You can go down to the basement and just hook a phone up and find out what the phone number is that way. It's not inconceivable at all.
Yeah, when I was in jail, actually, they had a bank of payphones, but they had all the phone numbers taken off so you couldn't get the phone numbers. So the first thing I did was I dialed 890 or whatever the number was, the code was, for that area, and I got all of the numbers to all the payphones and that made me very popular.
Uh-huh. Until you gave it out, I guess, and they had no use for you after that.
Well, yeah. Well, what I would do is give it out to the people who would protect me.
Uh-huh.
And
it's amazing how seven digits protect your life.
Yeah. Well, the idea is that in jail, nerds just don't have a place in jail. When you're dealing with there, it's the survival of the fittest, and these pale, geeky characters that sit at their computer terminals and don't have big muscles to protect themselves will wind up being at the low end of the stick in jail when it comes to any dispute or anything like that, and they get harassed continually. If you then become very good friends with a very big person and get on his good side, then no one will bother you.
That's the rule of the streets, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's see if we can fit in one more phone call, because we're almost out of time. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hey, Goldstein. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Okay.
And last week, you were talking pretty much in depth about how cellular phones are pretty much open for anyone with ears and something to pull it in out of the air.
Exactly.
I was relating this to my old man. He lives out on Long Island. And my old man still uses a manual typewriter, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And I'm telling him about this, and goes, "Oh, wait, let me tell you what's been going on." He's got a cordless phone in this house, in this tract housing in Nassau County, real close. And he said he heard a weird click on this phone. He went to pick it up, and he wasn't sure what was going on. He thought his phone was broken, so he unplugged it. And he's listening, and he starts picking up the people right next door to him, who he hates. They got the barking dog. They don't mow the lawn. And he's been listening to their conversations for weeks and weeks now, finding out stuff about them just to find ways to nail them or just do something real nasty to them in a way. So it's kind of weird how this thing is filtered down to the lowest tech person. I mean, this guy can't even program his VCR. You know,
what you've got there are two similar cordless phones that just happen to be using the same frequency. You're not even using a scanner. And it's so easy, you don't have to do that. And it's not cellular on top of that.
He wasn't going out of his way to try to find
it. No, it came to him. And that's it's an example of how the technology simply is not designed with the proper precautions in mind. Okay, we are out of time. Captain Crunch, I want to thank you very much for being with us tonight and wish you luck in your future endeavors. Sounds like you have quite a few of them, actually. Anybody that wants to contact Captain Crunch, you want to give out your address one more time? You there?
What's that?
Now, do you want to give out your internet address one more time?
Yes, my internet address is crunch@well.sf.ca.us. We're on a system called the Well in Sausalito. It's a relatively large online system, much like CompuServe or Bix. And I'm also on Netcom, crunch@netcom.com.
Okay. We're going to have to stop there because we are out of time. This is Emmanuel Goldstein for Off the Hook. And I want to thank everybody for listening, for calling in, and for remaining awake. And alert as far as technology goes. We'll see you again next week during Marathon. Take care. I caught myself while shaving. Now I can't make a call. It couldn't get much worse. But if they could, they would. Only the bounce was the best effect for worse. I hope that's understood. From the remote. Now
it's coming. Thrills like you've never seen before. Romance that